but lost the Electoral College.
So, do you think that the Electoral College system favors one party more so than the other?
I think it does not, but the other elements of non-democracy or anti-democracy in the Constitution creates an atmosphere where the Electoral College will end up screwing towards one party. But it's really the political system and the way the parties operate and the way our overall electoral system is structured financially and otherwise that creates the problem.
Okay. Dr. Clarence Lussain, political science professor at Howard University, the author of $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman, and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. Thank you so much for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake, Dr. Lussain.
Thank you. Have a great rest of the show.
All right, thank you. And our next guest is Dr. Wilmer J. Leon III with his perspective on last night's vice presidential debate. Stay with us. Back in a moment.
How does the bastion of the West democratically search out how to stay united as we churn out vitriol and bots and memes and try to work out how we can rebuild the trust and boost the turnout?
Apathy, finger pointing, idle institutions, threats of retribution and a threatened constitution. Not so fast. See, our founding fathers brought the wisdom, listing ways to coexist with our election system.
It hasn't failed us yet, and though it feels contentious, it's the only free and fair arena for consensus.
It's not perfection, but let's soften our objection. We simply gotta focus in on this election.
Monsieur Citizen.
Monsieur, what is this?
Purging eligible voters?
They're up to old tricks, changing all of the requirements for voter ID.
Vote riders,
they'll help you for free.
So what happens when we vote?
Well, without a doubt, the black turnout is momentous, especially in the South.
Spread the word and drive your friends.
Rock the vote, then see 6 million new black voters coming from Gen Z. Let's go. I improve my mobility through eligibility. I'm not throwing away my vote. I am not throwing away my vote. It's a party at the polls.
America decided
by ladies
who vote.
Woo!
You could say it's common sense we're voting for. In 2020, women cast 10 million more. You say the loss is I say it's reproductive, so let my message be instructive. We've won each time our rights were gambled, and we're picking reps who will persist. And if you call me a suffragette, huh, then check the internet, cause here I'm a suffragist.
Work!
Look it up, look it up. Check your status at whenweallvote.org.
Look it up, look it up. Check your status at whenweallvote.org. Next DM or text three friends to check for sure they are registered in the state or city they live now. Even better, you can show them how to register.
Cause it's easy to make it a norm. Go online, you can fill out a form and then
register.
Early voting can become a routine or through the mail, vote absentee if you
register.
It can ease your anxiety, voting your conscience upon your society. A healthier habit when you fill out a ballot.
Incoming
election season.
The moment we've been waiting for.
I am not throwing away my vote, folks.
We need all the help we can get. Go call your friends, sign up, organize, make sure they don't forget. Okay, what else?
Find your polling location. This nation depends on participation. To enact voting rights and rally to fight any efforts to disenfranchise.
Whoa.
It may feel bureaucratic, but our system's democratic. We can buck the status quo if we stay at it. So, election,
vote.
right, ham fam.
The cast of Hamilton, Vote 2024, the Broadway musical Hamilton, of course. So welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Now, when Governor Waltz and Senator Vance took to the debate stage last night, the tone was unexpectedly cordial to begin. Senator Vance, who has made up stories about Haitian immigrants eating pets and calling single ladies without kids a bunch of childless cat ladies, well, that Vance didn't show up. But there were numerous times Vance outright lied about policies and events. Governor Waltz, for his part, humbly admitted he misspoke about his actions in the past about Tiananmen Square in China, calling himself a knucklehead at times. But things heated up over one issue so badly, debate officials cut both their mics to regain control. The debate between the vice presidential nominees typically draw a lower viewership. But during this segment of What's at Stake, my next guest tortured himself and watched the debate, and we'll analyze some of the highlights for you this morning. Wilmer J. Leon, the third host of Inside the Issues with Wilmer Leon on Sirius Radio, and author of Politics, Another Perspective, Commentary and Analysis on Race, War, Ethics, and the American Political Landscape in the Age of Obama. Good morning, Dr. Leon.
And, good morning,
man. And welcome to, thanks for joining us this morning on What's at Stake. And thanks for toughing it out during the vice presidential debate last night. Your thoughts on the debate? Did it live up to your low expectations, or what were your thoughts?
Well, it was, actually, it was better than I thought it would be. And, well, it was form, if we look at this in terms of, all of this for me is in the context of form over substance. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the form of the debate, how both candidates conducted themselves and how they engaged with each other, I thought it was better than the presidential debate.
Okay. And so they did manage to sort of stay on policy and issues as opposed to taking personal attacks against one another.
Yes.
For the most part.
Mm-hmm. For the most part, yes. And that's where we get to the substance part, because in their discussions over policy, in a number of instances, they missed what I consider to be the substantive points of the policy, such as the immigration discussion, such as the conflict in the Middle East discussion. They really missed what I consider to be the substantive salient points. But for what it was they were presenting, they did that well. Hopefully that makes sense.
So on what, well, first of all, were you surprised at the J.D. Vance that participated in the debate last night? I wasn't
that much surprised by J.D. Vance's performance, because I have read in the past that he does that well. He debates well. He understands the dynamics of debate, and so the for the most part, the cat lady J.D. Vance didn't show up. So he understands the performative aspects of this and did that well. But I also thought, contrary to some of the stuff that I've read this morning, I thought that Waltz did very well. I think Waltz did better than Vance.
Okay. All right. So back to Vance, he performed in a way that Trump never could. Vance managed to stay on point. The Trump camp is claiming the major victory, saying he showed why Trump selected him as his vice president.
Well, I think that's wrong. Because again, this is not gymnastics. So it's not a matter of it. Substantively, it was vacuous. I don't know what to say. I was not impressed by J.D. Vance. let me say, I'll put it that way. I was not impressed by the guy.
No. Okay. Well, he had to be, they did a number of fact checking on his statements.
Well, I had to, because he lied. and he was very effective. Again, from a performance perspective, he was very effective at not answering questions. He was very effective at evading answers. But if you were paying attention, you'd sit there and go, oh, well, you know, dude, you didn't answer the question, or you're lying. His discussion on the abortion issue, Donald Trump has been very clear on where he stands on Roe. And no matter how much J.D. Vance tried to talk over it and tried to spin it, you can't get away from Donald Trump's stated position. It's very clear. And I thought Walsh did a very good job of highlighting that. Walsh made a huge mistake when it came to where he was during Tiananmen Square. That I thought was a horrific blunder. Once he said, I misspoke, I've done some knuckleheaded things, he should have just stopped talking. But there was this uncomfortable silence after he said that. I think it was because he still had more time on the clock. And in order to fill that uncomfortable silence, he started rambling. And I thought that was a very bad move. He should have just said, that's my answer, let's move on.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it. So you said earlier that you felt that Walz did well during the debate.
Yeah, I thought yes. When I watched and listened to him, even though there were times when he came across as being uncomfortable, he came across as believable. And again, I'm talking to the performance side. I'm not talking on the policy substance side. He came across as warm. He came across as, I think the word would be affable. He came across as humble and believable. To me, J.D. Vance came across as stiff, as calculating, and doing his best to spin the unspinnable. Because there, for example, they were talking about immigration and Walz made the very good point. Donald Trump said to, he points to the camera and says, Donald Trump said to you, he was going to build the wall and Mexico was going to pay for it. Only 2% of the wall has been built and Mexico hasn't provided a dime. He said, Donald Trump said that. And J.D. Vance, that's a fact. You can't run from that. Oh, and then Walz made the point. Vance kept talking about the Harris policy, even though there is no Harris policy because she's not the president. And he kept talking about the Harris administration, which there is no Harris administration because she's not the president. That Republicans and Democrats had come up with a bipartisan bill to deal with the border, and that Donald Trump stepped in and told the Republicans not to vote for it because he needed that as an issue. That's a fact. And J.D. Vance could not debate that fact. So he just started spinning and blabbering. And it was incoherent as far as I was concerned.
And he also wouldn't answer a question about if he would support a child separation policy.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
So
So on the surface, people might say, oh, he managed that well. But if you were really paying attention, you go, well, hey, man, you didn't. In fact, they came back to him twice on that, saying the question was, would you separate families where the parents came across the border illegally, but children were born in the United States, making them American citizens? He wouldn't answer that question.
I think he referred something to their being separated already through policies. So Do you think that maybe Waltz was a little bit too cordial and affable and not necessarily aggressive enough?
Yes. Because, for example, he made mention, if I had been there, I would have a number of times said, look, folks, the guy standing next to me called Donald Trump Hitler. Hitler, we all know who Hitler was. That's about as despicable of a human being as one can possibly be. You called the man Hitler. And now, and then J.D. Vance's point was, well, I've changed my position because I've gotten to know him.
And the media has made, and he believed media reports. I don't think any media was calling him Hitler.
You can't get there from here. What Waltz could have done and should have done was gone to Lindsey Graham's comments about Donald Trump. He should have gone to Ted Cruz's comments about Donald Trump, and he could have gone to Marco Rubio's comments about Donald Trump and said, why is it that all of these establishment Republicans feel publicly articulated their utter disgust and disdain for this man, and now they are standing behind him trying to convince you that he is a substantive serious candidate? That is unexplainable. He should have dwelled on that a lot more, and I think he would have scored more points.
On the economy, which pretty much everyone agrees that that's going to be a very important issue for voters on November 5th. Vance argued that Trump's economic plan would solve the cost of living crisis. On his first day in office, Trump has promised to impose historic tariffs and deport millions of undocumented immigrants. Waltz defended Harris's proposals and touted that his running mate believes in the middle class, pointing to the vice president's plans to make housing and home ownership more affordable and cutting taxes. That's such an important debate. How do you think each of them did on that?
I think each of them failed on that for a couple of reasons. One, the president, no matter who is sitting at the desk, really does not have significant impact on the economy. There are other factors at play that COVID, for example, president can't manage COVID. There are things that that a president can do to lessen or slightly improve an economic trend, but there's very little that a president can do to impact the economy. But what happens is people tend to assign their economic reality to the president that's in office. So this happened on your watch, therefore I am attributing this to what you do. So there are people who will say, hey, when Donald Trump was in office, I was doing quite well. My bank account or my ROI or whatever it's going to be went better than in the Biden administration. What people also don't really understand is the cyclical nature of economics. So a number of policies that a particular president will put in place may take a year and a half, or 2 years to actually materialize. So things that started at the end of the Trump administration that may have been positive wind up manifesting themselves in the first or second year of the Biden administration, and then people want to attribute those things to Joe Biden. So that's the first point. The second point is neither of them really have substantive economic policy. So once, Vance's point about, Donald Trump can come in and solve this problem, No, that's not going to happen. You can't control the supply chain problem. You can't control the strike that's taking place right now at the Eastern docks. And if that carries forward for, you know, 3 or 4 months, then the economy is going to find itself having a taking a serious hit. So, but the problem for Waltz is a lot of the policies that Kamala Harris is championing, they aren't going to work. So, you know, the issue about controlling a price gouging, it didn't work for Richard Nixon. What makes Kamala Harris think doing the same thing that Nixon did is going to work this time? She's talking about $25,000 for first-time home buyers. All that's going to do is raise the price of the house by $25,000. And in order to get that whole program moving forward, what is it? How many houses mm-hmm. have to be built in order for that whole? So there are elements to her policies. And one of the things that I used to say to my kids when I taught at Howard and taught public policy is that a lot of times we have to differentiate or separate ourselves from the philosophical versus the practical. There are a lot of things that, from a policy perspective, sound good or look good on paper, but when you try to implement them as policy, the realities involved cause serious problems. And so a lot of the things that she's trying to articulate, I believe, are going to fall into those categories.
So quickly, because we're sort of running down on time here, what about the Middle East? Waltz said the United States needs to continue to have a presence in the Middle East. Vance said it would be up to Israel if they wanted to launch a preemptive strike on Iran after the country launched missiles toward Israel on Tuesday. How do you think those points landed with voters listening last night?
Well, they probably landed well with those that subscribe to the current policy, but the current policy, and it's not only a Biden policy, it's an American foreign policy, is an absolute failure. You can't back genocide. Genocide is wrong, period. Full stop. To Vance's point, Israel is not an independent actor here. Israel cleared their strike on Iran with the United States. Israel cleared their strike on Lebanon with the Pentagon and got the green light to do so. In fact, there's an article in the Washington Post, I think it's in the Washington Post, or it's in Politico. There's an article in Politico today that makes that very point. So J.D. Vance saying that, you know, well, not answering the question about do you support another strike, passing it off to Israel, no, because Israel is conferring with the United States. The United States is providing them all the artillery, all of the weaponry in order to engage in this strike. So he can't pass this off as though Israel is some independent actor here. That's just BS. So and now, the policy is wrong.
So overall, do you think that Waltz accomplished what he needed to accomplish? What was his assignment going into that debate? And did he accomplish it?
I think his assignment was demonstrate you are competent. And I think he did that. Again, this is a performative answer. I'm not speaking to the substance because there were a lot of holes and flaws in the substance, but that's holes and flaws in the Harris-Waltz policy as there are holes in the substance of the Trump Vance policy. But from a performative perspective, I thought he did well.
So you think he advanced the Harris message?
No, I don't. Well, he advanced it. I don't know that that's going to translate into people being more comfortable with that ticket. Vice presidents, you know, as the adage is, they won't win you an election, but they sure can cost you one. Mm-hmm. I thought the guy came across in all of his, with all of his flaws, and there were some, I still think he came across as human. He came mm-hmm. across as thoughtful. He came across as competent. J.D. Vance came across as a debater.
Well, what could he, as you said, the adage, vice president can cost you an election. Mm-hmm. Do you think he is going to cost, his performance last night would cost Trump's election?
No. J.D. Vance's performance is not going to cost Trump the election, because he really would have had to fall flat on his face for that to happen. Those that are going to vote for Donald Trump are going to vote for Donald Trump no matter what happens. They are so wedded to that racist, xenophobic, irresponsible foolishness that they're going to do that no matter what. There are probably some undecideds, and there are very few there, that looking at J.D. Vance doubling down on that racist lie and trope about Haitians eating animals, that'll just say, well, no, we can't buy into that. The problem for the, as my colleague Dr. Lusain mentioned a little earlier, one of the problems for the Harris-Waltz ticket is going to be Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And Clarence didn't elaborate on this, but the problem is that's where the largest contingent of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans are consolidated in this country. And that Gaza policy is not going to bring those people to the polls.
I see.
That could cause her or them serious, serious problems. And wow. really quickly, one of the mm-hmm. other things that I saw that Waltz didn't do was he didn't correct J.D. Vance. I made this point earlier, but he didn't correct J.D. Vance on, you keep calling these policies Harris policies. She is not the president.
Exactly.
She's the vice president. If you know, and then he could have said something like, well, if you understood civics, you would know. So.
Yeah, she would have been doing the president's job if she had done everything that he was holding
right.
her
right.
accountable right. for. Okay, so you think any undecideds went to one camp or the other after last night's debate?
There are probably, if undecideds went anywhere, and I think at this stage of the game there are few, but if mm-hmm, undecideds went anywhere, they went to the Harris camp based upon that performance.
Okay, all right. Dr. Wilmer J. Leon III, host of Inside the Issues with Wilmer Leon on Sirius Radio, and author of Politics, Another Perspective, Commentary and Analysis on Race, War, Ethics, and the American Political Landscape in the Age of Obama. Thank you so much for being our guest this morning. On What's
Thank you,
State.
Verna. Appreciate it.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thank you to our listeners. You are our raison d'etre. Thanks to our engineer extraordinaire, who happened to be our program director, Katia Stitt, this morning. And up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Faye Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.
obsession is the motivation that is hanging up the goddamn nation.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
And I'm Robin Holden. This is Reggae Music and the Reggae Experience present a WPFW fundraising concert featuring Image Band, Curlew Reggae All-Stars Band, Lady Flame, and Carl Malcolm.
On Saturday, October 5th, 7 p.m. until midnight at King Solomon Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue Northeast.
Tickets available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW.
All proceeds to benefit WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
On Sunday, October 6th, 9 a.m. until midnight, WPFW presents De Colores, celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month. Our beloved Sunday programmers will explore the rich musical palette of Latinx artists, from the strings of Villa Lobos to Salsera Graciela, to the Cuban jazz and electronic sounds of Omar Sosa. That De Colores, celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And you are in tune to your station for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM locally, and WPFWFM.org streaming worldwide. This is indeed a station building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Up next is Dr. E. Fay Williams with the prolific words of our dear brother Dick Gregory and Wake Up, Stay Woke. So please stay tuned. For riveting discussion, you're in tune to WPFW Washington.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away?
In the meantime, good morning to you on production. It's great to be. I hope you're having a great time out there. This is WPFW FM 89.3, and I'm Fay Williams, your host, here on Wake Up and Stay Woke. You know, we do this program in remembrance of the one and only Dick Gregory. I know we have a guest this morning who should be with us on Zoom any minute now, But in the meantime, don't forget, this is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I don't know how many of you have had a family member or someone you've known who had breast cancer, but it's something that many families go through, and we pray for those families today. Delta Sigma Theta has been playing a big role in announcing and reminding us that this is National Breast Cancer Awareness Day. And so we want to let you know that the President of the United States has a proclamation on National Breast Cancer and on National Breast Cancer Awareness Month being this month, October. So we hope you will recognize it. The president has said, my administration has also worked hard to make cancer treatment more affordable for patients. And he has strengthened Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. Those are good things as he gets ready to leave or his administration gets ready to leave us. But he has been here for the last 3.5, a little over years, and we'll be bidding goodbye after, I think, about 50 years in public service. His proclamation reads basically, now, therefore, I, Joseph R. Biden Jr., President of the United States of America, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and the laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim October 24th as National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I encourage citizens, government agencies, private businesses, nonprofit organizations, and other interested groups to join in activities that will increase awareness of what Americans can do to prevent and control breast cancer and pay tribute to those who have lost their lives to this disease. I have heretofore set my hand this 30th day of September in the year of our Lord, 2024, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 249th. Today, that was from President Joe Biden. You can just give a friend a call today that you know may have breast cancer and you know it. Sometimes you don't know, but if you do know, or a family that has a family member, you know, you may be a friend of a family member with breast cancer in their family. So please contact them. Just give them some love today. Okay. I don't know if my guest is on yet. Let's go to the switchboard and ask if my guest is on yet.
Not yet, Dr. E, but hopefully Attorney Shabazz will be with us shortly.
Okay. All right, then. Well, there's a lot going on. I don't know how many of you watched the debate last night, but just wondering what you're thinking about it. It was an interesting one. We heard some truths and we heard probably a lot of untruths. I hope you were able to recognize what was what as you were listening last night. It is so important for us to be listening carefully to what we're hearing candidates say in these days, because sometimes they get real slick, you know, they try to pass something off that's not quite true. But if we are keeping up with the news, we're reading, we're listening to people we trust, then we'll make the right decision on November 5th. Don't forget, that's election day. And the other thing you shouldn't forget is that, the campaign, the election has already started. There are some states that are voting already. I don't know how many of you have states that are voting now, but those are some in the basket, you know. But there are many people out there who have not yet voted. And if you know the answers to questions, you have a duty to help people understand it and not to put them down because of who they're choosing to vote for, but rather to try to help them understand what is going on, what this election means to us, and who it is that's going to do the things based upon their past. If they're going to do the things that are going to help our community, that's important. You know, sometimes we just think we don't like a person, but if that person is doing and their record shows that they do many things to help the community in which we live and to do the things that we want them to do, then that's the person to choose. It's irrelevant whether you like the person or not if they're doing things. And don't forget, we listen to many television programs, many radio programs, read many newspapers, and we get absolutely conflicting responses to many of the things that's going on. So please, please be careful what you read. Be careful who you talk with. Get their ideas, but don't take everything for granted, because this election is very consequential. And when we vote, just remember the person we're voting for is going to be with us for the next 4 years, So we have to determine whether we want to live with that person for 4 years. You can't come, you know, January 20th or whatever and switch persons. You've got to have made up your mind on November 5th what you want. Now, many people think that it's good for us to vote early whenever our state opens up. That's a good thing, because sometimes there's bad
Attorney
weather.
Attorney Shabazz is here.
Yes. Sometimes, you know, we have bad weather, we have hurricanes, we have all kinds of things that will sometimes keep us from going out to vote. So let's do early voting wherever you can. Again, this is WPFWFM 89.3, and I'm Faye Williams, your host. We've always got a lot to talk about here on this public affairs program, because there's so many public affairs. I mean, I'm not saying there's not some other kinds of affairs, but we're talking public affairs here. And today we've got one of my favorite people on. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fine. Dr. Williams, I'm doing fine, and I'm honored to be on with you and your esteemed audience here in Washington, D.C.
All right. Well, we've got someone that I consider, he may not know it, but I call him my son when I'm talking to people. He's one of America's brightest young attorneys, known for his work in civil rights and social justice and just so many things. He's currently president of the Black Lawyers for Justice organization. He does litigation. I mean, he does litigation in some of the dangerous places. And I want to ask you, Malik Shabazz, how do you do it? What is it? What gives you your courage to do some of the things that you do? Are you with us? I think we may have lost him again. So let me go right ahead telling you about some of his work and what we're going to be talking about today. I don't know what's happening. Maybe the switchboard will inform me. But anyway, Malik Shabazz is one of those young men who was born, 25 years after I was born. And he's doing some of the great things that I certainly admire. Are you back with me, Malik?
Yeah, I'm back. I had the wrong button pressed. I want to say, ma'am, thank you for your compliment. Gratitude to you and things that keeps me going on so many fronts is inspiration that I've received from honorable spiritual mothers such as yourself and spiritual guides such as Brother Dick Gregory, Honorable Louis Farrakhan, Khalid Muhammad, Johnny Cochran, and other people in this town like Attorney Donald Temple, who's on this line, and Greg Latimer and others. So I'm honored to come in the tradition of the greats, and I'm blessed to be doing a strong work here and around the country.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that you are. And, you know, I'm always ready to go whenever you ask me to go someplace to help with something. And I continue to do that. I know some people say to me even sometimes, aren't you afraid of the things you do? And, you know, I say, absolutely not. Once you get involved and you start doing things and you know that what you're doing is right, you're not afraid. I mean, you don't even think about fear. You just think about getting the situation resolved that you're involved in. I know you've been into a lot, and we're going to get to one of those, the key ones that we're going to talk about today. So first of all, talk a little bit about the District of Columbia and the coming election. What do you think we need in Washington, D.C. that we don't have right now?
Well,
is it something about courage? Is it about what is it about? More people being involved?
I mean, when you talk about Washington, D.C., and what I know as a college student at Howard University and Howard Law School, you know, I know this is Chocolate City. I know this is a town where Marion Barry is the mayor, and I know this is a town that normally has about 9 black city council persons. And so what I would say right now is that we're in a drastically different time. We're in 2024, and the black population and influence is decimated in Washington, D.C. We've had the development. We've got a lot of development in new buildings and stadiums, and we all enjoy a lot of that. But we paid a heavy price for that. And the price that has been paid is the decimation of of the black influence is continuing to erode under a litany of crisis. And so, you know, I mean, is it the real estate crisis? Is it the development crisis? Is it the affordable housing crisis? Is it the crime crisis or violence crisis? You could pick it. But I would just say as black professionals and leaders, we have to take serious note of what's happening in our town. And we do have the leadership to combat it, but we got to wake up fast and be selfless and combat this problem.
Well, you know, I think about something that seems very simple. I live in Southwest D.C., and I run into people all the time who've been hit by bicycles. It seems that bicycles are all over town. They run across the street illegally. They get in front of you. You just don't know. Sometimes they're even on the sidewalk. And I know that I contacted my city council person about doing something about these bicycles that is so dangerous. There are many elderly people who live in Southwest D.C., but it's not safe over here. I have to walk in my, you know, around my condo here because the streets out here are just not safe from bicycles. And I'm not opposed to people having bicycles, but it seems they have no rules for them. They can crisscross the street, you know, when the light is not on, and they can run up to you. It seems they have no responsibility. I don't say none, but I'm saying some bicycle riders, and there are many over in Southwest Washington. Have you heard any complaints about this? I know that I sent a message to my city council. I've not heard anything from him, and I don't know what it's like around the rest of the city, but that's a big issue in D.C. and particularly in Southwest D.C. Have you heard any complaints on this issue?
Yes, ma'am, I have. What you are describing is amongst a litany of complaints about the adverse effects of gentrification. So this is these bike lanes and the influx of dogs and so forth. And these are the cultural changes that are going on in Washington that are a result of intense gentrification. We live in one of the most gentrified cities in the United States of America. Gentrification comes from the English root word gentry, and I mean fundamentally the city is changing to a culture where those who ride bikes and have dogs or whatever they have imposed their way of life on the black population, and some of it is a severe inconvenience. Yes, I've heard complaints. There are many complaints going all around here. So our population, we must know this. Black Lawyers for Justice and other community groups that we work with right now here in this city, what we're doing, we're on October 26th, we're at the great honorable Pastor Willie Wilson's church. We're at Pastor Willie Wilson's church for our all-day conference on the crisis and the conspiracy to destroy Black Washington, D.C. Now, at this conference, there are going to be many organizations and leaders that we're going to help and assist and teach our people the science of organizing to get their needs met. You know, when you're talking about your issues there in Southwest, when you're talking about our issues in different areas, well, we must know the science of how to wield political power in this city. It's a political science, I mean. Mm-hmm. And you must know what numbers to call, what buttons to push, and we have to become a coalition, a united coalition to address our concerns because others are getting their concerns met. They're organizing and they're getting their way around here. And we as a black community must know the science of using advocacy, law, activism, and everything that we know, and we can bring some changes to this serious problem.
Yes. You know, I want to mention just one more thing about the bicycles and the danger of them, particularly to elderly people who may be not even hearing them, but it seems that people should be required to use bicycle lanes, but they shouldn't be allowed to crisscross and speed, you know, and come on the sidewalk, even when they're bicycle lanes. I'm 1.5 years now suffering a cracked shoulder from a bicycle hitting me. And that's why I'm very conscious of this issue. I haven't been able to use my left hand for quite a long time now. and nobody seemed.
Can you hear me? I'm sorry, Ms. Williams, can you hear me?
Attorney yeah. Shabazz, why don't you keep talking? We're trying to see what has happened with Dr. Williams. So if you want to expound on what you were saying, why we try to get her back.
Okay, fine. Let me keep going then. Okay. All right. My sisters and brothers, you know, who are listening, it's terrible to hear how I...
This Saturday, October the 5th, there will be a national summit on gun violence and racism in person at the Metropolitan AME Church, 1518 M Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., and online at forsummit.org. The summit is a unique, solution-driven gathering of activists from D.C. and across the country, sharing policies and strategies successful in reducing violence and saving lives. The event is sponsored by the Fellowship of the Reconciliation under the leadership of...
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that. We want to go to another issue. We know that you are a lawyer. You are a key lawyer, major lawyer, wonderful lawyer around this country. And one of the major cases that I want you to bring us up to date on, I know you've been on and you've talked about the case down in Mississippi. And that's why I asked you, first of all, about being courageous, because that you are. We've worked on cases before or situations before where I know that you were not afraid. I was not afraid. Sister Nia was not afraid. I mean, we call ourselves warrior, women warriors, the Nia and me and Josephine, who's head of SCLC, Sister Nia, head of the area's National Action Network, and I'm in charge of the Dick Gregory Society. We go where we're needed, and if you ever call on us to do something, we know that it's a good thing to be done. Now, I hope you don't call on me to go to Mississippi, even though you're finished with that one. I am.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I do. I want to go to the Mississippi case. I know you've been on, you've talked about it before, but I just want our listeners to know the status of what's going on there and how you got involved.
Yes, you can. Okay, so sisters and brothers, we've switched topics here now. We're talking about my legal work in Mississippi on one of the greatest or strongest cases that's still going on in Rankin County, Mississippi. Now, Dr. Williams, you know, my family and my mother is from Mississippi, and she served as a secretary for Mega Evers, her and my aunt. Now I come back to Mississippi via being an attorney for the Emmett Till family. So as I'm attorney for the Emmett Till family, working on the prosecution of Carolyn Bryant, who had not passed at that time but should have been prosecuted, there I looped back in with you. And we went on a strong mission in Kentucky to advocate for the prosecution of Carolyn Bryant, part of my multifaceted work as the attorney for the Emmett Till family. I want to also give a shout out to my sister Nia 2X, who backed me up for a long time, and she worked us together. Okay, so from the Emmett Till case, then they wanted me to work on the case of Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker. Michael Jenkins was a victim of the Rankin County Goon Squad. Now, many of you all have heard or seen on TV or the case of the Goon Squad or seen me on national TV about the Goon Squad. They are six white officers in Rankin County, Mississippi Sheriff's Department that have been viciously beating and abusing and torturing and sexually assaulting and people for years of all races, till they got down to doing this to Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker one night, and they made a fatal mistake of conducting a mock execution at the end of their two-hour torture and a sexual abuse session. They put a gun in Michael Jenkins' mouth, and it fired, and Michael Jenkins was shot, and then everything has come tumbling down from then. Through our advocacy at Black Lawyers for Justice, and we petitioned the United States Justice Department, and the U.S. Justice Department took up our case and took historic actions. The Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Justice Department took historic action in Rankin County, Mississippi.
Let's pause a moment. Who's over there at the United States Justice Department that came to our defense there?
Absolutely. It was. The Honorable Christian Clark, who is the leader of the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Justice Department, who is doing an historic work all over the country in this hour, and who spearheaded through her staff in the Southern District and others, the prosecution of these six vicious white officers in Mississippi, which resulted in plea agreements and sentencing by Judge Thomas Lee in federal court in Jackson, Mississippi, resulted in the strong sentences of a total of 132 years for these six officers. 40 for Christian Dedman, 37 for Brett McAlpin, 20 for Hunter Elward, 17 and a half, and 10 for the three others. These were historic sentences in a state, can you believe it? Mississippi has never prosecuted a white police officer in its entire history at all for harming a black person. Not one time has a cop done a day in jail for harming a black person, and we know that they've been harmed over and over again. And so these historic actions come about, we have to say, through a woman who is unheralded, but they need to know that the Christian Clark's miss, or sister, Christian Clark at the U.S. Justice Department Civil Rights Division, now she's certainly doing her job over there. And she's to be commended. They have opened up, and not only since the Goon Squad has been prosecuted, they have now opened up a pattern and practice investigation into the whole department, not just the Goon Squad, but launched a serious federal investigation into Sheriff Brian Bailey and the whole department, and they have acknowledged that this is systemic. Now, part of all of this is the work of Black Lawyers for Justice, Attorney Shabazz and Attorney Trent Walker, and others in Mississippi. I want to say Priscilla Teal, the Teal family, and others, because it takes strong advocacy. It takes work. It takes relationships. And it takes knowing how to press and advocate legally and otherwise in this system to be able to make some progress. And so, yeah, we made some historic progress in Mississippi with the convictions. We're in the middle of the civil lawsuit case in terms of getting Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker their just compensation, and we represent others, serious other victims in Rankin County, Mississippi, and our work there is by God's grace, it's historic in this hour.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Priscilla. She was related to Emmett Till, correct?
Priscilla Till, yes. Priscilla. Till is, she's Emmett Till's cousin, and she represents the Mississippi family of Brother Emmett Till. And in my helping her and being her attorney in her passionate pursuit to have Carolyn Bryant prosecuted, she, in turn, has been a key leader and demonstrator and activist for our cause in Mississippi and putting that pressure on the Rankin County Sheriff's Department, and also being a caring and loving person and figure to Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker, who were in the dangerous back parts of Rankin County, Mississippi. You said earlier about danger and fear. Yes, ma'am. In Rankin County, Mississippi, there is danger. And in Kentucky and dealing with Carolyn Bryant, there is danger. And yes, I have received death threats for my work on behalf of half of our people. But y'all know me from Howard University, and you know me from my struggles at Howard University against some of the same issues we face today.